listeners. This is Dan Kowalski, host of the Alaska Story Project. The motivation and inspiration for this project is to talk with authors, scientists, artists, historians, fisher poets, and a colorful cast of characters who are both knowledgeable and passionate about Alaska. Storytelling has always been key to how we connect as humans, piquing our curiosity and deepening our understanding. Our podcasts are unhurried, so we invite you to settle in and explore with us some of the richness that makes Alaska such a special place. Without further ado, let's begin. My guest today has a bio, how should I describe it, that is accomplished and skookum, such that it seems to me a good idea would be to invert it and begin with the present. So my guest lives in a lovely Pacific Northwest town with his sweetheart and his dog named Lucky. So as a young man, he was in the Marine Corps, worked as a merchant seaman, a charter pilot, a commercial fisherman, and more recently, he was the author of Death and Oil, a true story of the Piper Alpha disaster on the North Sea. Another book, Jacques Cousteau, The Sea King. Another book, Descent, The Heroic Discovery of the Abyss. The New York Times bestseller, Titanic's Last Secrets. And Planet Ocean, a story of life, the sea, and dancing to the fossil record with artist Ray Troll. His bio also includes working as a creative producer for The Shape of Life, an 8-hour National Geographic television series on evolutionary biology, and authoring the accompanying book. He's been published in numerous prominent magazines, was the editor of the Alaska Fisherman's Journal, and the Pacific editor of National Fisherman magazine. With that, it's my pleasure to introduce writer Brad Mattson.
Always nice to spend time with you, Dan. We've been doing it for 45 years, so we might as well keep it up.
Oh, my dog. That makes me think that we're lucky.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Well, Brad, when I put my hands on this remarkable stack of books here, what occurs to me, what strikes me, is that a presence in virtually all of them is the presence of water and the ocean. I'd like to delve into that more. You write in your essay, Finding My Range, you begin with a Lauren Isley quote, "If there is magic on this planet, it's contained in water." And then you write, Brad, "Water revealed itself to me one August morning when I came on deck to finish my coffee and ease into the chores that begin every day of salmon fishing, a time that lends itself to reflection." So with that as an intro, I'd love to hear your reflections on your relationship with water.
I guess I can say, if I can get a drum roll, I fell into it. And it certainly wasn't intentional. I was always drawn to the sea. I migrated to Alaska when I was 19 years old. There was a captivating presence of the ocean, especially in its dramatic form in Southeast Alaska. So there was all of that kind of inspiration. And then there was simply the matter of genuine interest in all things that seemed to have to do with the water, whether it was fishing or swimming or just sitting looking at it. I've had many moments in my life when I sat and looked at the ocean and thought, you know, this is the brain of the planet. You know, this thing is sending out something that is so powerful that it's impossible not to be affected by it, even though it seems so inert. And the other thing, of course, is its vastness. I think of a wonderful cartoon. One of my books is about William Beebe and Otis Barton descending into the Atlantic Ocean, becoming the first human beings ever to descend beyond sunlight. And Beebe had a cartoon on his desk at the Wildlife Conservation Society in New York, then called the Bronx Zoo. Two little kids standing on the beach, and one of them says to the other, he says, "Boy, the ocean is so vast." And the other kid says, "Yeah, and that's just the top of it." So it's always had that level of fascination for me.
And in the essay in The North Coast, one of the things that I appreciated is you dropped into some of the physical properties of water. The fact that it is in, we find it on planet Earth in three states, and how some of those unique states make life possible.
Yeah, that the water molecule is really quite something. The physiological properties of water. It's in the essay "Salmon in the Trees" as well. The pointed dolphin scene. I think I'll read that later on.
Yeah, we look forward to that. Well, very good. And so, if we were to carry on the books that I've got in my hand, tell some stories about Planet Ocean and knocking around with fish artist extraordinaire Ray Troll.
Oh, yeah, sure. Ray and I were a blind date. I had a good friend who was the editor at Alaska Northwest Books, a marvelous editor named Marlene Blessing. She called me up one day and she said, "This guy in Ketchikan just sent me this big pile of drawings of fish." And she said, "They're absolutely wonderful." She said, "But I don't know what to do with them. You want to meet him?" And I said, "Well, who is he?" "Ray Troll." I said, "Well, I met him one time in Ketchikan. He was playing in a band up there at a friend's wedding." And I said, "Yeah, put us together." So I was living in Queen Anne Hill at the time. I was working at the National Fisherman magazine, and Ray came by. This is in the early 90s, and Ray came by with a tray of slides, and we sat down at my kitchen table and didn't stand up for 6 hours. And we just had this instant connection. The next day, as I account in the book that came out of this, Shocking Fish Tales, Ray and I went to Port Townsend and visited the Marine Science Center, and also established, for the rest of our work together, which continues to this day, established road trips as a key element of the creation process. So,
Well, the title and the the concept, the meme, if you will, of Planet Ocean is as vast as most of us think of the ocean. How did that come about?
Well, we did Shocking Fish Tales, which was the collection of those marvelous drawings that Ray had done of fish over the years while he was selling fish in Ketchikan and gradually becoming the Ray Troll that everybody knows now. And we did publish Shocking Fish Tales, and in the process of doing that, we had such a good time. We knew we wanted to do something else. And we realized that looking back just in a very cursory way into the history of human beings, that we are essentially fish. And not just in our ontology as we emerge from our egg sacs. We have gills, and we are descended, all life on Earth, essentially on dry land, is descended from the first fish that came out. So anyway, that to a couple of kind of wandering guys who were looking for something to do, tracking the history of fish and its relationship to human beings, sounded like a pretty wonderful project. And that's how Planet Ocean came about.
I see. And so that gives some insight into what you guys meant by dancing to the fossil record?
Yes, and we had a number of books that really influenced us. One was Stephen Jay Gould's Wonderful Life, which and the account of the discovery of the Cambrian explosion in the Burgess Shale. And we kind of went down the rabbit hole with paleontology. At the same time, we're fish biology and the history of fish were exploding all around us. So it was a combination of things that took us into the fossil record, kind of almost you know, without us even knowing it. And Ray had been having a very successful career with his T-shirts on which there were great illustrations of fish. And there was some trepidation in his family that we were dragging ourselves off down some hole that was going to take him away from what had been filling his rice bowl for a while. So anyway, we just followed our noses. We made a huge road trip into the fossil beds of North America. That's what we did. We drove around for 2 years and came out with that book, came up with them.
Wow. Well, so mutual fascination for, as you indicated, the ongoing friendship and collaboration with one very interesting Ray Troll.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, and then After that, ran its course with museums and road trips and books. And did you take time off, or was there another project? What was the next project?
Well, commerce reared its ugly head, unfortunately. In the late 90s, Ray and I had published 4 books together, I think, 3 or 4, and we were splitting royalties, and I really just couldn't make a living. So I took a break, which I had done a couple of times in my 50 years as a writer. It's kind of like clearing your throat, but I joined the Peace Corps when I was 55 years old to take a break. And when Ray found out about it, we had already been to the Amazon, and we had a kind of a project cooking on the Amazon River that is still, in a way, cooking. We're actually working on it at this moment again. But and Ray turned it into a museum show, but I didn't participate. And, Ray was somewhat upset, so I went up, and he and I went on a 3-day fishing trip and settled our hash, and we were okay. And off I went into the Peace Corps for 2 years. And when I came back out again, I decided that I wanted to continue as a writer. When I left, I thought I really wanted to quit being a writer, which I think is a very good idea for a writer to do, to quit being a writer every once in a while, because your identity gets so wrapped up in it, you get in your own way. When I came back, I had a job. I had a fellowship at the Sitka Center for the Environment in Oregon, Lincoln City, Oregon. I had a wonderful 3 months down there, and I got a job to write 6 children's books. On the ocean, of course, and one of them was on William Beebe and Otis Barton, who were two men in the 30s, one kind of a wealthy heir to a textile fortune, and the other probably the most famous natural history interpreter of his day, William Beebe and Otis Barton. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I had that was one of the 6 books that were for children at the time about the ocean. It was called Incredible Ocean Adventures. And when I had finished that, I at the same time, I had also gotten very interested in horse racing. And so I bought a small share in a thoroughbred and got real interested and wrote a series of television treatments set at Belmont Park, each one of them ending with a horse race, and I thought, how can this miss? So I had a wonderful new agent in New York, a literary agent, so I wrote him an email, and a long email, 2 pages on the Belmont Park horse racing idea. And at the end of it, I said, oh, by the way, I just finished this children's book on these 2 guys who had themselves sealed into a steel ball and lowered into the Atlantic Ocean off Bermuda. And I sent it to him, email, and I got an answer back in less than 2 minutes, and he said, I like the 2 guys in the ball. So my great horse racing idea crashed and burned, but I was off and running on this idea of writing a book about William Beebe and Otis Barton. It's a fascinating story. It's kind of an anti-buddy story because they were 2 men who accomplished great things, but they really hated each other. And it was very interesting. Anyway, there's a lot of interest in the book. And the other thing that was consistent for me with what I wanted to do in recovering what was left of my life, I was 57 at this point, was I had written a lot of environmental advocacy stories for Audubon, Mother Jones, all kinds of magazines. National Fisherman became a very important environmental advocate. And what I realized was that I was writing for the same 225,000 people. And I wanted to start, and this really began too with Ray Troll. We wanted to create books about responsible stewardship for the ocean by kind of looking to the side of it. Mm-hmm. We wanted our books on the dashboards of pickup trucks, in the hands of people who wouldn't ordinarily pick them up. And so that idea was further kindled with the descent story, because I thought, okay, you want people to be interested in the ocean? Tell them something interesting about it. You know, don't hit them on the head with diminishing resources and human blame and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, fascinate them. You know, just get them into it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm holding Descent in my paws, and during this period of time writing this book, what would you say caught your fascination with the story the most?
Well, these dives occurred during the 30s, and it was a time when, and I'm sure even the most casual glance back through human history, there was a time when we didn't know everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was like the 30s was a really amazing time for first highest balloon trip. You know, the August Picard goes up in the balloon and touches the stratosphere. Mm. Fastest speedboat, fastest airplane. Mm. Humans were doing all these things that were not, they weren't Guinness record type things. They were just the first time humans had ever done them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was fascinated by Beebe and Barton, thinking, especially Beebe. Beebe had an amazing capacity for visualizing the unvisualizable. Mm-hmm. And what he was saying was, what he wanted to do was take an 8-mile wide circle in the Atlantic Ocean off Bermuda and explore it. And Beebe, among other things, had pioneered the use of field stations.
Mm.
A field station was a place where scientists would go and study nature over an extended period of time, which at the turn of the century was very rare, because what scientific exploration had been up to that time was primarily taxonomic expeditions where people would go collect things and leave.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't stay. So Beebe was really the first ecologist.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually trying to understand whole systems.
Mm-hmm.
And now I've stumbled across this guy, Beebe, who wants to do it for the ocean. And I thought, oh, that's right up my alley, you know. So,
well, there you
so
go.
That was pretty good. I enjoyed that part of it.
Yeah, well, right on. Well, again, holding the book in my hands, it's compelling, start to finish, including the cover. Another book I've got in my hand right now, with a smiling countenance, strong presence, and then a stripe across the cover that says Jacques Cousteau. What a trip to devote how many years developing a relationship with the man, the family, his career, his explorations. Say a little bit about this book.
Sure. I had finished Descent and it enjoyed some moderate success, and so the publisher was interested in something else for me, and I was at a complete loss. And a friend of mine said, has anybody ever written a biography of Jacques Cousteau? One morning at breakfast. And I said, you know, I don't know. So I took a quick look, and there had been a couple of hatchet jobs that I later learned why, because Cousteau wasn't an entirely pleasant human being. But I wrote a one-page letter to my editor at Random House and got the job the next day, which ordinarily when you write a nonfiction book, you write a proposal. It's usually 40 or 50 pages. You submit it. They sit on it for 6 months. You know, nobody talks to you. You worry about it. And finally, they give you a small contract to write the book. And anyway, that's the usual process. So I was able to sell the biography of Cousteau on a letter. To Edward Kastenmeyer, my editor. And I just was fascinated at every turn with this man's life.
Mm-hmm.
He was a phenomenally curious man, which to me is pretty close to one of the reasons for living on Earth, is to be curious. And Cousteau had it all that way. He was also a classic narcissist. So, you know, if you were on his program, you were his new best friend. But if you weren't, he didn't know who you were. And a lot of people, I ran into a lot of people as I I spent 5 years on the book because I worked on it for 2 years. And then I had the opportunity to write another book that took me 2 years. And my publisher gave me the 2 years off. And then I went back and finished Cousteau. So I really had Cousteau on the desk for 5 years. It was pretty wonderful, and I, like I say, at every turn, and of course, I got to go to Bordeaux where he was born, and, you know, darn it, all that wine over there, and enjoy, you know, roaming around his childhood home, and spent a couple of, made a couple more trips to France, because that's pretty much where he lived. He lived in Monaco. Monaco is a city they call a sunny place for shady people. But he had an apartment there. He was a citizen of Monaco. Anyway, it became a labor of love as well as, you know, a potentially good commercial success. So.
Kudos. in the pile of books, another notable one in my hand, Titanic's Last Secrets. And In the bio, it was it sold well, a New York Times bestseller for a period of time. Give me an idea of how you got into this and what you found most interesting about this book.
Well, this is the book I stopped writing the Cousteau biography to write, and it was proposed by John Chatterton and Richie Kohler, who were the protagonists of a very successful book called Shadow Divers. And they had spent some time aboard the Mir submersibles descending to Titanic and had consulted with a marine architecture firm that had come up with an alternate theory for why the ship sank. And when they proposed this to me, actually they proposed it through my agent, they proposed it to me, they said, we have a guy in Belfast who used to work at the Harlan and Wolff shipyard, and he has documents that he took from the Harlan and Wolff shipyard that proved that Titanic was a weak ship and that the owners knew it.
Ooh.
And so how could I say no to that? So, and the other thing was that the editor who eventually ended up buying the book was a man named Jonathan Karp, who's now the president of Simon & Schuster. But he was an absolutely wonderful editor. And from the moment I met him, I knew that I wanted to work with him. He was the high point of the book for me. There were many thorny problems in the writing of the book. Some of the facts didn't shake out exactly as I thought they were going to shake out. And of course, when you're writing a book about Titanic, you always have to remember that more words have been written about Titanic than any other episode in human history, except the assassination of JFK. So, you know, I was faced with trying to say something original about about a subject that was by itself or on the surface of it just trite.
Well, good on. I'd like to shift in the interest of time to talking about Salmon in the Trees. How did that essay come about? And I look forward to, as if this were a book reading, hearing most of the essay.
Sure. Over the years, some of the books that I've written have been essentially collections of independent essays or separate essays. Some of them have been whole stories as whole books. This one, Salmon in the Trees, came to me because a good friend of mine, Tom Jay, was asked by the Island Institute, people in Sitka, Alaska, the Island Institute, who had proposed to write an anthology to collect a series of essays by Alaskan and other writers about the Tongass Forest. And the idea was to create it as an influencing tool in a series called Literature for a Land Ethic. It was published by Milkweed Press in Minnesota. And they gave copies to all the members of Congress. And the idea was to try to educate people in a pleasant way as possible about the need to preserve as much of the Tongass National Forest in Southeast Alaska as possible. Mm-hmm. I couldn't say no to that. Mm-hmm. I went to Sitka for a couple of meetings with those Carolyn Servin and Don Snow and some of the other writers. We got together up there and came up with the the idea from a dinner that was held at Ray Troll's house in Ketchikan, at which a biologist came and talked to us about the relationships between salmon and trees and the fact that not only do salmon need the trees, but the trees need the salmon. And it seemed like a pretty worthy theme.
Yeah. Well, if you will, please share the essay with our audience, Brad.
Sure. I begin this essay with a epigram from Barry Lopez, who wrote, "One of the great dreams of man must be to find some place between civilization and nature where it is possible to live without regret." Salmon and the trees. I'd better tell you right off that I have never seen spawning salmon actually in the spruces, hemlocks, alders, or any of the other trees in the rainforest that embraces the Alexander Archipelago. I have seen them in the creeks, of course, during the warm months when they arrive from the sea, vital and silver, only to turn into ragged monsters to surrender to their descendants. I take a 1-2 punch of mortality and renewal every time I stand on a muddy bank and watch those beautiful fish turn into tatters right before my eyes, with their next generation tentatively on deposit in the streambed gravel. They disguise themselves, and then they disappear altogether as though they are determined to blend with the moss, bark, silt, debris, and the earth of the place. It's hard to resist thinking of those fabulous recently departed salmon as ornaments dangling from the branches of the trees, clattering around up there like wind chimes. Since we started to suspect that hacking down the rainforest would kill the salmon, it's important to know that the trees need the fish as much as the fish need the trees. And as it turns out, wishing that salmon really spawn in the trees of the Tongass isn't just a matter of having a hyperbolic imagination like mine. At a potluck in Ketchikan a few years ago, a geologist showed up with hard evidence that salmon eventually do make their way into the trunks, branches, leaves, and needles. The menu that evening was predictably delicious. Baked halibut, hot dish, salad, and wine. The food of every winter anybody has ever spent in a Southeast Alaska town. The company was similarly comfortable. About a dozen of us who ate and helped our host take some art off the walls for the slideshow. Then for an hour, we sipped decaf and wine, while the geologist, an exuberant man named Jim Bechtel, told us about his enchantment with the limestone karst and old-growth trees of Prince of Wales Island way out to the west. His slides were portraits of lush trees and groves, clear-cut ridges, saddles and valleys, and people on claustrophobic expeditions into the labyrinth of caverns and tunnels that underlie the familiar surface terrain. In some of the pictures, spelunkers are hanging on ropes in dead-drop shafts more than 500 feet deep, grinning. In others, dusty cavers bathed in the glow of headlamps and strobes are wedging themselves through subterranean gaps barely as wide as their hips. They're equipped with special straps on their boots, Jim explained, to allow their comrades to extricate them when they get stuck. Over the rattling of the projector, Jim also told us stories about the geologic skeleton that shapes the archipelago and serves the trees and the salmon. Imagine a braid of a half dozen gigantic strands of ancient rock winding on a southwest to northeast line like Rapunzel's hair wrapped together and laid against the continent. These six tendrils are the remnants of distinct terrains, pieces of drifting crust that docked against the old, old rock of the North American plate. and they fused together over hundreds of millions of years. The rocks vary wildly in origin, age, and kind, but all of them seem to submit to two generalities. They were once buried deeply and then uplifted and exposed by glaciation and erosion, and their grain is consistently parallel to the long axis of the archipelago. A great fault, one of the most obvious and beautiful in the world, cleaves the entire assemblage in a fracture more than 300 miles long, now occupied by the waters of Chatham Strait and Lynn Canal. To the east on the mainland lies what pioneer geologist John C. Reed called a truly stupendous body of granite. We know it now as the Coast Range. The uncountable crags that pucker into the sky at the thoroughly unnatural border between Southeast Alaska and British Columbia. To the west, the island rocks are metamorphic and sedimentary melanges that include gneisses, schists, phyllites, slates, limestones, and marbles. In most places, the limestone and marble are 10,000 feet thick. The quarries at Toquin and Marble Island have barely touched what is estimated to be 800 million tons of high-quality marble that would be the envy of any Renaissance sculptor. The four great columns in the facade of the state capitol building in Juneau are Toquin marble, and from 1909 to 1932, more than a dozen quarries dispatched shipments of rock around the world. The point of Jim's entertaining explanation of the geology of Southeast Alaska was to lay the groundwork for his argument against cutting the old-growth trees on the outer islands. If, he reasoned, the limestone karst could be as valued as the timber above it for recreation and research into the history of the place, there would be a reason to stave off the logging juggernaut that threatened the trees. Under a set of Byzantine timber harvesting rules, the great trees of the world's last temperate rainforest were being cut and shipped to plants that turned them into chewing gum wrappers, beaver board, and other pulp products. This so-called industry operates at a net loss to its owners, the people of the Tongass, the United States, and Earth. It is subsidized by some of the foulest-smelling legislative pork ever to come out of Congress, accompanied by the bleat of jobs versus the environment rhetoric. Some people rebelled, finally, like Jim Baichtal and others inside the United States Forest Service, who are supposed to represent the best interests of the nation and the world. The men and women of the fishing fleets headed for the barriers, too, along with a lot of other people, who grasped the complex dependencies of the Tongass. For a time, the chief strategy to counter the brute political muscle that kept the timber barons afloat was to demonstrate what was euphemistically called multiple use. The outer islands of the archipelago, Baichtal told us, were likely among the first to emerge from the ice 10,000 years or so ago, and some patches of terrain might even have remained ice-free throughout the cold era. They were refugia for animals, including bears, deer, and salmon, and quite possibly humans, who rode out some pretty rough times together or just moved through the remains of the island group on their way to better living in the south. Baichtal and others also figured that the relationship between the karst, the trees, the salmon, and every other living thing is not well enough understood to permit the removal of a single, terribly consequential element of this version of life's formula, the trees. The biggest, healthiest old-growth trees grow where they do because the porous limestone beneath a thin covering of soil and organic debris is nothing less than a massive storm drain. The karst, the trees, the caves, the salmon, even the people, Baichtal said, are parts of an immensely interdependent, complex system about which we still know very little. The returning salmon definitely pack nitrogen and other essential ingredients of forest life in their bodies, and they surrender them year after year after year. The fish rot quickly and find their way into the trees in the guts of bears, humans, birds, and other animals that leave their droppings in the forest. Eagles and osprey haul whole rotting salmon around like takeout waiters, depositing their remains in the uplands, where the porous understory and rock deliver the meal to root webs. I was reminded that night in Ketchikan of a wry bit of environmental humor. How does a Buddhist order a hot dog? Make me one with everything. The removal of the trees and salmon of the archipelago in ignorance of their true value to the system of life into which they are woven is not without precedent, that's for sure. We humans have limped along with oversimplified notions about taking what we call natural resources from places like the Tongass chiefly because we perceive ourselves at the center of the consumptive cycle. We are also impeded in our judgment by the human lifespan, less than 100 years, and economic systems which contain no real long-range vision. Only in the last quarter of this century have we begun to understand that this old-growth forest has far more value than the dollars contained in top-grade wood products and its cosmetic charm for the tourist industry. The forests also purify water, store carbon, and enable salmon, bears, humans, wolves, birds, deer, insects, worms, and countless plants and creatures to exist. In a complex relationship with all other life, the trees stabilize the giant organism we call the earth. Salmon have helped to deliver the news. They have been food for as long as other predators have been around to eat them, and human myths, ceremonies, and respect have been engendered as much by gratitude for a meal as by appreciation for their enigmatic spirits. Pacific salmon are anadromous. The word means uprunning. They are born in freshwater, migrate to the sea to mature, return to freshwater, and spawn. A classic example of ordering a hot dog wisdom links fish to rocks to trees. Salmon probably became anadromous to adapt to the cycles of ice and water that have dominated their range since the Pleistocene, when they evolved to their present form in the cold, nutrient-poor freshwater of northern latitudes. From time to time, great glaciers completely hush the continental rivers and lakes beneath crackling blankets of ice and drove the fish to the sea. Salmon are among the quickest studies in the evolutionary drama, able to change so rapidly in just a few generations that geneticists favor them for experiments in mutation and adaptation. They evolve the physiological and biochemical traits necessary to migration, homing, and survival in both fresh and salt water, and further refine themselves into hundreds of races distinctly bound to specific watersheds. Every salmon is a member of not only its broad taxonomic species like king or coho, but of a natal subgroup from their particular stream or river, marked by distinct traits such as scale color, size, flesh color, and even taste to a predator. All Pacific salmon share common patterns of emergence, maturation, and reproduction that bind them to their streams and shape them for ocean survival. Chief among the mechanisms of survival of the species is sheer abundance, since going the distance from egg to spawner is a numbers game. If S is the number of salmon that must return to perpetuate a healthy run, thousands of times S must be fertilized eggs. My numbers are not scientific fact, but comparisons of magnitude that vary for each species. Hundreds of times S must survive the delicate emergence into alevin, flashing bits of protein becoming living creatures in full view. Then still hundreds of times S must survive to become fry, real fish with their egg sacs consumed, their bodies zipped up, fins and tails. Then as smolt, the new fish begin actively eating and being eaten. Nature is a workshop, not a temple. Herons, gulls, eagles, osprey, and other birds thin their numbers as the salmon make their way downstream to the sea, and seals, sea lions, otters, and bigger fish wait hungrily in the estuaries. On most rivers at the end of the 20th century, the salmon are also put in dire straits by logging that destroys their spawning habitat, pollution, dams, and urban sprawl. Once in the sea, predators, including fishermen, claim their shares of the salmon runs, further reducing S, until finally the survivors reach home to spawn. Though their powers of navigation are studied and celebrated, it is probably their genetic programming that allows a few of them to stray in every run. In that way, they can survive the natural destruction of their spawning streams by ice, floods, and fire, and try to find a place to establish a new run. They are sadly having trouble adjusting to the chainsaw. The earliest treaties, agreements, and conciliations among the people of the Pacific Rim sorted out rights to salmon, first as matters of tradition, then as matters of law, but always because salmon are vital as food. The Tlingit and Haida people of ancient Tongass watersheds defined their band and family relationships according to ancestral rights to particular streams and salmon runs. Only in the 1950s were those fishing rights officially abrogated by the courts of the United States as part of the first land settlement between the early people and the recently arrived Americans. By that time, the industrial fleets and packers were in full flower, migrating north each year to take advantage of the last thriving salmon runs on the planet. By mid-century, they had been through total collapse and renewal several times, chiefly because they did not live in the watersheds they plundered. For thousands of years in the human relationship with salmon, nobody trapped, caught, or ate anything anonymously. The links between water, fish, trees, and people were not scientifically defined, but they were perfectly clear and understood in taboos and traditions. Commerce in distant markets and cash economies broke those instinctive bonds forever and replaced them with the impersonal networks of industrial fishing, canning, and freezing. Now, salmon reach tables around the world, but most of them carry no ecological return address. Stewardship has proven impossible at a distance. To modern people, dams, timber, and great cities were part of the vision of paradise. Engineers were priests, and the forces of nature mere puzzles with certain solutions. Coastal and watershed destruction to encourage commerce is not an aberration of industrial culture, but a definitive characteristic, and no nation can claim restraint on behalf of salmon. Even today, as the somber notes of acute ecosystem crisis are sounding in dozens of North American watersheds, cavalier politicians support destructive logging and mining practices in Alaska and British Columbia, assuring us that they will not harm the few healthy salmon runs that are left. Millions of people in Asia and Europe are already paying the true price for similar alterations in their relationship with salmon habitat. The mainland drainages of the Tumen River, Amur, Anadyr, Markova, Elbe, Danube, Rhine, Thames, Spey, Hudson, and Connecticut, and the numberless shorter water courses of the Newfoundland, Kuril, and Japanese archipelagos once were graced by massive salmon runs every year that are now gone. As miners' canaries for the health of watersheds, salmon carry a message of distress by their absence. A watershed without salmon is no longer singing the song of life. Until recently, early and modern people relied upon superabundance and their ability to move on if they overfished a salmon run or trashed a stream or other life support system. Alaska, including the fragile watersheds of the Tongass, is the last place to run to. Our understanding of the complex dependencies of the rainforest is still incomplete, but we finally suspect that we are living incompetently, that we have evolved unsustainable relationships with our food, shelter, and water. The feedback loop of excess and consequence is closing, though, and we are once again, as were early people, realizing that we cut no tree and catch no fish anonymously. For a short time, I fished for a living under the apparently simple terms of anonymous extraction. It was a wonderful life. One night in a bar in Sitka, Alaska, for instance, another fisherman pointed out that trolling for salmon in southeast Alaska is one of the last best things a liberal arts major can do for a living. The Pioneer Bar is to commercial fishing what Sardi's is to the theater in New York, a big warm room with black and white photographs of fishing boats and fishing people instead of stage celebrities covering every inch of the walls. In a meandering but eloquent monologue, my friend argued that studying literature and history, along with a fear of real jobs, is perfect preparation for hard and dangerous work on small boats, rewarded by great beauty and just enough money to pay the bills. But even before my friend delivered his inspired vision on that well-lubricated night, I knew that I would have gone fishing for nothing. The water, the forest, the people, and the salmon of the archipelago were enough to claim me. Trollers often fish alone, catch salmon one at a time on hooks, and depend upon guile, instinct, sham, trickery, and luck for success. The kings and cohos I hunted traveled thousands of miles to complete the circles of their lives in the streams they inherited from the previous generation. They are wondrous creatures that have been around for millions of years, track the magnetic field of the earth to navigate, and return carrying nutrients from the deep sea to their ancestral watersheds. Though I was paid to catch them to feed people all over the world, fishing for salmon was anything but a job. Trolling in Southeast Alaska was this. I am at anchor in the lee of Point Adolphus, an idyllic promontory on the north end of Chichikov Island, directly across icy straits from Glacier Bay. There, the Pacific Ocean invades the northern reaches of the Alexander Archipelago through a gap just a few hundred yards wide. At speeds of up to 8 knots, the sea encounters its first major terrestrial obstacle at Adolphus. When the current peaks, that collision churns the water into a symphony of feeding fish, birds, seals, whales, and porpoise. Fishing, therefore, was often great, especially when accompanied by the primitive pleasure of knowing that I was just another creature clinging to the very visible marine food web. The sensory snapshots of that morning evoke fish, water, and trees. The ocean roars and swells, gathering itself into rips and maelstroms of astonishing power, while swarms of thrashing needlefish, herring, and salmon stipple the surface. Synchronized swarms of northern phalaropes flash alternately brown and white, as though to the tapping toe of an invisible choreographer who occasionally orders them from the sky into undulating rafts on the chrome-black water. Beyond the phalaropes, a few miles across the strait, through clearing tendrils of fog, are the peaks of the Fairweather Range and the icy uplands of Glacier Bay. The rivers of ice are remnants of the thick skin of frozen water that as recently as 14,000 years ago covered not only the strait where I lay at anchor, but all the entire hemisphere to the North Pole and south to the latitude of Puget Sound. As I sip my coffee on deck, the water itself enchants me. There, on display in its three astonishing states, liquid, gas, and solid. Water is odorless, colorless, and tasteless, a compound of enormous stability and a powerful solvent that is repelled by most organic substances but attracted by inorganic materials, including itself. Water expands when frozen, rather than contracting like most substances, so the solid is lighter than the liquid, which of course is why ice floats. If water suddenly started behaving like almost every other molecule and weighed more frozen than as liquid, life as we know it would depart. Ice would sink to the bottom of the oceans, and the summer sun would not be strong enough to melt it at such great depths. Life in the water would cease, the seas would disappear, the hydrologic cycle upon which our existence is based would grind to a halt. Our food is not only mostly water, but utterly dependent on it. A 1-pound loaf of bread has used up about 2 tons of water while the wheat was growing. A salmon needs the water of an ocean, a stream, and a forest to grow. I remember that morning at Point Adolphus 40 years ago, like a poker player remembers a pat hand, because the sensual feast kindled a new awareness of the bonds between the water, the trees, and the salmon of the Tongass. By the time Jim Baichtel put salmon in the trees for me at that potluck in Ketchikan, most fishermen in southeast Alaska had caught on, too, and joined ranks with environmental advocates and other outraged citizens to force reform of logging practices and preserve priceless salmon watersheds. Unfortunately, to many people, trees and salmon are still just commodities to be consumed, rather than deeply connected parts of the same whole. Separating them in the minds of people who eat and use them remains a disservice to all. The jobs versus the environment paradigm continues to corrupt our political solutions to abusive logging. And at the fish market, you can buy farm salmon from pens instead of streams and the sea, further relieving consumers of the demand for stewardship. Maybe we'd all get the picture if each farm salmon carried the brutal truth like the one on a pack of cigarettes. This salmon cannot spawn in trees and may be hazardous to your health.
Brad. Right on. Oh. So many things invoked there. The lyricism of sweet times.
Oh, yeah.
Chasing salmon on the water.
I know.
Some of the challenges that remain to this day. Humans doing the, I would hope, the best they can to manage and balance the demands of our modern circumstances. A marvelous glimpse into southeast Alaska and the Tongass. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Yeah, been a pleasure.
As a bit of a coda, Brad, invoking that early morning with a cup of coffee and observing the water and the qualities of light, and temperature and humidity, the water. You said that it's a very good time for reflection. And my curiosity would be at this station in life, what do you find yourself reflecting upon now?
Well, I'm coming up on 79, so I reflect on getting up in the morning and trying to enjoy my girlfriend and my dog and you and people around me when I'm around people. I find myself very much engaged, since the James Webb, with cosmology. I'm fascinated with the evolution of consciousness. For me right now, I am just absolutely preoccupied with the wonders of existence, just being alive and what that means. And there's so much noise in the world, and I am fortunately living in a place where I'm able to tune it out. And it is very easy to do that, actually. There are things you just avoid, and that's what I'm enjoying. And I think that there's a light and a dark part of the internet, of course. And one of the light parts is that I can go online now and listen to a lecture by a very reputable person on the evolution of consciousness, and then I can listen to 10 more. And it's really quite wonderful, that, and also just taking time to just sit and think, to kind of do nothing. And there are quite a few penalties for being old, but among the rewards are you kind of eat when you're hungry and sleep when you're tired and, think when you want to just sit there and think. And so that's kind of what I do. I find that I don't interact socially as much as I used to, probably simply because I've done that kind of interaction so much in my life that I don't really feel a need to do it. I don't feel hungry for people as much as I used to.
And maybe one last thought. If you were to pull a thought and offer it to a 24-year-old person in this country, what might that be?
That's a big one. I was sort of faced with that last June. I took my 20-year-old grandson, Milo Bendixson, lives in Oslo, Norway, and he flew over, and we took a two-week road trip, and I'm sitting there in the car, we're driving. We drove down to Vegas and across to the coast and up Big Sur for a couple of weeks, and mostly I just listened, and, you know, occasionally there did come a time when it was like I'd have to blurt something that seemed to be important, and for me, most of it was about being curious. I think that curiosity and allowing yourself to be fascinated as a way of bringing you together not only with people in collaborative situations, which is the secret to success, no matter what everybody says about the competitive nature of evolution, we have got to learn to collaborate on this small planet. When I was born, there are 2.5 billion people on Earth. There are 8 billion people now. You know, there's a big message in that. And the message essentially is we've got to learn how to get along with each other. Things along those lines, they tend to be somewhat phenomenological rather than ideal-based or institutional concept-based. And I guess in terms of whatever advice leaked out of my seat into the seat of my beloved grandson, it is, you know, avoid institutions and just dig how cool it is to be alive. Just this experience of being here. It's astonishing. It's really wonderful.
Right on, Brad Mattson. And lucky Milo for having you as a grandpa and to take a road trip through this astonishing, amazing, complicated planet Earth, planet ocean that we find ourselves in. So, Brad, big thanks. Another CODA question would be, if somebody is wants to get a hold of your books, where would you send them?
Amazon has them all in various forms, Kindle, audio, like that. I'm not very facile with media, but a friend of mine put together a website, so I have it's a blog site. But if you just Google my name, you'll find a whole bunch of things. Brad Mattson, and then there are places to buy the books. So.
There you go. Well, big thanks to you, Brad, for the time, the attention, the conversation here, and big thanks to the Alaska Story Project audience. Thank you, listeners. Shout out to Christian Arthur for his amazing music that accompanies the Alaska Story Project. And encouragement to share this as you're able. And what I like to say is ... to be continued. On we go. Thanks, Brad.
Thank you, Dan.